And LSU was back on the beam, 49-21 over an outmanned Central Michigan team. The Tigers opened their SEC season Saturday at Mississippi State. In studio to begin our week, a real treasure and a pleasure, Dr. Hippolyte Landry.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you, sir.
He calls every now and then, and we're always pleased to hear the distinctive voice of Dr. Landry, who on Friday, September 17th, turned 95 years old.
Yes, sir.
You look like you're no older than 74. What's the reason? How do you stay young?
I guess I stay active, Jim. I go all the time. So I guess that's it. I'm lucky that I have good heritage, I suppose, too.
You were born in, what, 1926, right?
Yes, sir. 1926.
So you've seen some stuff. You were 15 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. Do you remember that?
Oh, very well. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, and I have had Hippolyte on for various reasons through the years. He's one of the last physicians to examine one Elvis Aaron Presley and also set a world record for traveling by plane across the globe, completely around. That was quite an adventure. During the Vietnam War, you were flying over some treacherous territory, weren't you?
Well, I didn't intend to do it, Jim, but when I left Bangkok, I had been in two thunderstorms between Karachi, Pakistan, and New Delhi, India.
Well?
And so you don't like to get naturally in a light airplane in thunderstorms. And the weather was good from Bangkok looking down to Singapore. But when I got out at daylight, Vietnam was to the left, and I saw all these big thunderstorms in front of me. I wasn't going to get back in them. And I had talked to the boys that were fighting in the war in Bangkok, and they said they fought until 5 in the morning, and then they went to sleep. And so I looked over Vietnam, and it was clear, so I made a 90-degree turn and flew right south of Saigon. And they called me, the Viet Cong called me, but I didn't answer them, and nobody shot at me. And in 1 hour, I was over Vietnam because it's only 200 miles wide. I was out over the South China Sea. So
how long did it take you to go around the world?
23 days.
23 days. That was a record. This was, what, 1969?
Yes, it was. And it's been broken since then.
That was 52 years ago, so you would have been a young lad of 43 then.
Yes. Uh-huh.
43 years old, traveled around the world, set a record, 23 days. And what kind of plane were you using?
I was in a Beechcraft Bonanza. It's a beautiful airplane, single-engine, 200-mile-an-hour airplane. And it had I had a trailing antenna that would go out the back end, and every 2 hours I would give my position report. I didn't have GPS in that days, so it was all dead reckoning. But I would say this is latitude such and such, longitude such and such, and so the big guys flying troops to Vietnam and the Pan American Airways way up above me, I was at 10,000, 11,000 feet. They would call me and they said, "Hey, what kind of airplane are you in down there?" And I said, "I'm in a Bonanza." They said, "How many engines has that thing got?" I said, "One engine." "One engine? What in the hell is you doing out here in the middle of the Pacific?" And I'd say, "I'm looking for El Dorado." And then it all crack up. And then I'd get my harmonica and I'd play. And they would all laugh.
So before there was Haley Arsenault, there was Hippolyte Landry. What do you make of her, this young woman who survived cancer, works at St. Jude's, from Baton Rouge? I knew her father, Howard, well. We went to school together. He died tragically of cancer, but she's made quite a splash.
Well, I haven't followed it that close, but it's certainly a monumental thing to watch.
At 95, would you go in space like that if you were invited?
Oh, well, certainly. I'm in good health.
Yeah. Well,
you're safe up there as you're on the ground.
A listener wants to know about your personal habits. And, I've seen you with some of the most beautiful women on the planet through the years. So Hippolyte's certainly a person who likes companions, and nothing wrong with that. But what about smoking, exercise? Did you refrain from smoking?
I did smoke way back. I quit many, many years ago. I smoked intermittently, but I never was a smoker. And I've just always liked women. Just in fact, on my birthday Friday, I took seven beautiful ladies to supper Sunday.
Seven.
at a steakhouse, and then I had them all over Saturday night, and in a band over too. I should have called you up, Jim. I didn't have your cell phone.
I would have attended, but seven women take it easy with the Eagles. Four who want to own me, two who want to stone me, one who says she's a friend of mine. Hillbilly Landry, who lives large and has lasted 95 years. Another listener says it must have been sobering for you to lose your colleague, Edwin Edwards, who died a few months ago at the age of 93. He didn't make it as long as you.
No, but I've got a good story about him, like most people do. When I was elected coroner, I was going to establish the detoxification center, which I did, which is a history in itself. But when I needed some money, I didn't have any money, and I had a building. I secured a building from the mayor president, and to put the detoxification center. In that time, there was no treatment in Baton Rouge for drug or alcohol, and I had made a campaign promise that I'd establish a detox center. So I needed some money, so I called up Edward, and he said, well, come have lunch with me. So I went to the mansion. There were 12 people there eating. But after it was over with, the trooper said, come on in the back, Dr. Landry. And he brought me in the back with the governor by himself. He said, what can I do for you, Hippolyte? He called me Hippolyte. I said, I told him about the detox center, and I said, I need some money. He said, how much do you need? I said, $100,000. He picked up the phone, got me $100,000. And so that started the treatment in those days, everybody went to Jackson Gym. If you had a mental illness or if you had, no matter how much money you had, there was no, or alcoholism or any schizophrenia, there was no treatment in Baton Rouge at all. And everybody went to Jackson. So starting a little detox center was great. I was running a 21.
Well, another listener asks, how many years were you coroner?
Eight terms. From 72 to 98. So, I was elected eight times, I think.
So talking well over 20 years, 26 years.
Yep.
26 years. So you saw death in all of its various forms, and some people can handle that, others don't. You obviously were able to. How did you do that? And did you learn things from seeing people at the end of life, at the very end of life?
Well, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about mental illness that I didn't know. That I was just a general practitioner. I wasn't a psychiatrist, so I became a partial psychiatrist by going to Jackson and learning. I flew up there every week on my off day and learned how to be a psychiatrist. So yes, I learned a lot, obviously, and I knew nothing about rapes, and of course, the coroner's responsible for the investigation of all rapes. So I had just, with the help of the district attorney's office, O.C. Brown, and a bunch of ladies, and we established a rape crisis center, which is a boon for Baton Rouge. It was a 2% conviction when I went in, and when I got out, it's a 95% conviction of rape because of the O.C. Brown, the district attorney, and Mrs. Womack, Milton Womack's wife, and Milton, and they established with all of us the Rape Crisis Center. So it was a wonderful experience.
Well, God bless you for staying the course and for spending time with us. Let's keep it going. Happy 95, Hippolyte Landry.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
One of Baton Rouge treasures. And with us now is David Fahrenthold, the man from Houston who's been with us once before. Pulitzer Prize winner, National Reporting 2017 was the year, covering Donald Trump. And he has, David does, another piece about the former president. And this one involves time out of office. And the president, as we know, has been, former president, has been a busy bee. And David notes in a Washington Post piece that in June, former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin visited Israel to scout investments for his new company, then flew to Qatar for a conference. And at the time, Mnuchin had been out of office for 5 months, but because of an order given by Donald Trump, he was still entitled to protection by Secret Service agents. Agents followed Mnuchin across the Middle East. The U.S. government paid up to $3,000 each for their plane tickets, $11,000 for rooms at the Qatar Lux St. Regis, according to government spending records. And the records show that taxpayers, you and me and everyone else, spent more than $52,000 to guard a millionaire on a business trip. David Fahrenholz, your thoughts about the Donald Trump finances, a gift that just keeps on giving. It's a story that I think warrants attention. Your thoughts?
Well, I thought this mattered because this was a situation where Trump, in his last days in office, as you said, extended something that had not been done before, extended Secret Service protection after he left office to all four of his adult children, as well as three top officials in the White House, including Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. That's not in the law. There's really nothing in the law that says you can do that, but he did it.
And we do have to take a 90-second pause, but we will continue on the Trump trail with one of the best reporters in the whole wide world, David Fahrenholz, back after this. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. David Fahrenholz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, is with us, and his latest work shows that Donald Trump, the former president, ordered protection, Secret Service protection, for a variety of officials who no longer are doing business on behalf of the government but are doing so on behalf of themselves. Steve Mnuchin, a primary example. And this expenditure is truly a drop in the bucket when it comes to the overall U.S. budget, which is swelled to enormous proportions, as we know. But still, it is a significant thing. And in past iterations, people might even be indicted and go to trial for this kind of thing. But with Donald Trump, it seems to be just another day in paradise. David, who reported extensively on Trump's finances, including his bogus foundation and Trump University, it seems the former president in some ways gets some relief that others don't when it comes to this kind of scrutiny. Why do you think?
Well, one thing that I've always tried to write about Trump is ways in which he has used the public good for private benefits. You know, he got a lot of our system gives presidents and people around them a lot of benefits. And how did he use those in a way that put money in his own pocket or that helped his friends? You know, that was different than the way past presidents had used them. So, I mean, and that's continued. That's why I'm sort of still on the beat. It's continued after leaving office. Since leaving office, he's lived at his own clubs. The Secret Service has to stay with him there. He then charges the Secret Service for the rooms they use while protecting him. He's brought himself more than $70,000 already. That's money straight to him. And this month, the dollars you mentioned that were spent on protecting his children and his aides, that's basically a private benefit. That law doesn't allot those people, that Trump gave them anyway. These are wealthy people. Mnuchin has a $300 million net worth. He wants security. He can pay for it himself.
A listener, Tracy at the Capitol, asked if it was you, and I believe it was, who reported that Trump actually used his foundation to buy money for an oil painting of himself. Is that right?
That's right. He actually did it twice. He used two different times. He used money from a charity to buy a painting of himself.
877-217-5757 for David Fahrenholz, Washington Post. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with David Fahrenholz.
Good morning, gentlemen. You're doing a great job, Mr. Fahrenholz. You know, I read an article in the Washington Post a few weeks ago where this Trump political PAC, Save America, some of that money is being used to rent space in Trump Tower. And the article read that most of the time the office is empty or it's only a couple people there. So evidently this is another Trump ripoff of his own supporters.
That's right. You're exactly right. This is another way Trump is sort of using the power he had, using the money he has access to because he was president to help himself. Trump Tower has some office space in the middle. It's supposed to be leased out to other people, and that office space is increasingly empty for a variety of reasons. It's kind of old. It's hard to get into because of security. People don't want to be in Trump Tower. And so as that space empties out, Trump is using political donations, money his supporters give him for political goals, to put in his own pocket. So he's using, as David said, he's using the money given by his political supporters to rent a big space in Trump Tower. The money goes to his company, and the space is basically unused, and he gets the private benefit.
Do you think the former president, will ever see a day in a courtroom involving his financial dealings?
It's a good question to ask today, because there's actually right now, as we speak, a hearing going on in New York City in the case against Trump's company. This was an indictment filed back in July against Trump's company and its CFO, Alan Weisselberg, saying basically that they broke the law, they committed felonies by committing tax fraud. the question, we've been trying to figure out the same question. That investigation, which is by the Manhattan DA, was targeted at Trump. You know, they didn't set out to get Alan Weisselberg. They set out to get Donald Trump. But we haven't so far seen any indication that they are close to indicting Trump or, you know, putting him in a courtroom for any reason, partly because it's so hard to, you know, in financial crimes, you need to prove that the person who broke the law understood what the law was and knew what the tax fraud law was and broke it anyway. Most executives who get in trouble nowadays hang themselves with email, and Trump doesn't use email. So the prosecutors would be trying to get somebody in his inner circle, like Weisselberg, who's worked for him for like four decades, to turn on Trump. That might happen, but mm-hmm. It makes it a real uphill climb. And right now, I would not put the odds at greater than 50% that Trump himself gets indicted.
You say he never uses email?
Never uses email.
Which may be smart in this day, but he does text, doesn't he?
He makes phone calls. He sends letters. He has people send tweets, obviously, or used to on his behalf. But he does not produce a paper record. And I think that started out as maybe just, you know, he didn't adapt to technology. But it's been very beneficial here because it's hard to have like a real time look at what was Trump's state of mind when he made this decision or that decision. If you don't have access to emails or, like you said, texts from him on those days, you're depending on other people's recollections.
Well, while he is fighting his own battles, he also, as I get daily emails from him, he's plotting his comeback and has rallies scheduled very soon and some that have just been completed. But he marches on and will, I'm sure, make an effort to come back. But Joe Biden has his hands full right now. And the New York Times today says no president has ever packed as much of his agenda, domestic and foreign, into a single piece of legislation with $3.5 trillion on the table that Democrats are trying to wrangle through Congress over the next 6 weeks. What are your thoughts about Biden's attempt to get things done amid strong opposition from the Republican minority, which is a big minority, and almost all are solidly loyal to President Trump?
It's interesting the way that Biden's agenda has changed. I mean, as you recall, when he ran in 2020, he ran as somebody who was sort of a uniter. He would say, you know, the Republicans are crazy right now because of Trump, but once Trump is off the stage, you know, then we can start to work together. You know, that's been proven right more than I thought. I mean, there were some good Republican votes for the infrastructure bill in the Senate that proving by, and there was a Republican or bipartisan compromise sort of showing that Biden's vision could come true. But this is now going to be about the Democrats. Can they, within themselves, agree on a package that can get 50 votes in the Senate and can get a majority in the House? I think they will, because they all know the clock is ticking, and they don't want this to be like healthcare, where they sort of let Republicans try to, you know, claim negotiation and then run the clock out to where they Democrats can't do anything else. I think this is going to get done. What it will look like when it gets done, I don't know. But I think that the experience of healthcare in 2009 is going to make the Democrats get this done in the next 6 weeks.
One of the most powerful people in the world today, certainly in Washington, is Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, former governor of that state. He represents the state's second in coal and seventh in natural gas production. And there are reports that he has stock that involves his family's coal brokerage. Does he have a conflict of interest?
Well, he certainly, he doesn't need stock in a coal brokerage to give himself a conflict of interest. He's got to get reelected in West Virginia, which is a very Republican state now, and where coal obviously is, although not the industry that it was and not the employer that it was, still has a very powerful political hold. So that, you know, to the degree that any climate legislation is going to be passed in this Congress, Manchin's going to have a really powerful role in shaping it. And so I think the rest of the Democrats are going to hope that they can throw enough money at things in Manchin's state that he will allow them to do some things that hurt coal in some sort of abstract way. The coal industry is declining. There's no bones about that. So it's not like, you know, coal will thrive if Joe Biden loses the next election. The question is, how can they sort of manage Joe Manchin, and how can Manchin explain his vote to people in West Virginia while also doing some things for the climate?
And lastly, David, a listener asked a question about the future. Donald Trump basically thumbed his nose at norms of the past. He didn't have any kind of trust for his businesses. It was business as usual while he was running the country. Will future presidents take the Trump method, or will they go back to the old way?
Well, I'll be interested to see that. Certainly, Trump showed that you didn't have to do it the old way to win. He didn't release his tax returns. He didn't put his business in a trust. He didn't, you know, he like patronized his own businesses all the time and gave them government money. He was sort of a unique situation. There aren't that many other presidential candidates, at least on the horizon, that have that kind of business holding. But I think he's shown that if you are, you know, proud of it, and if you sell it as sort of like a, you know, a selling point of your personality, that the voters are not going to insist that you back away from your businesses before they elect you. In fact, in Trump's case, I think that his business acumen, his business connections were a big reason why a lot of people voted for him.
David Fahrenthold, many thanks. Always a pleasure. One of the best reporters and continues to do top of the line reporting from the Beltway. Washington Post, David Fahrenthold, Pulitzer Prize winner. We're back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. We go from Pulitzer Prize winner David Fahrenthold to Pulitzer Prize winner Tyler Bridges, who reports for The Advocate. He's got not one but two books in the hopper, one that is completed that he will be showcasing very soon about his father, and the one that's coming soon will be next year, the 40th anniversary of the Cal-Stanford game. Tyler is a product of Stanford University, Leland Stanford Junior University in Palo Alto, California, his hometown. He's now in Philadelphia doing some research on his book, but we're going to talk to him about a few different matters in our time with him. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. And I've noted over the last few days that Louisiana lost a rare fellow, a guy who was truly one of a kind. He was an individual, Vincent Bruno, and Tyler knew him well, and Vincent is captured in all his glory in Long Shot, the book that Tyler collaborated with Jeremy Alford on about the 2015 Louisiana gubernatorial election. And before we move to other matters, Tyler, Vincent Bruno, he leaves a void for those of us who knew him. He was a character.
Yeah, he was definitely a Louisiana character, involved in a lot of different things over the years. Probably best remembered, and many people won't remember him fondly, is leading the police union that went on strike in 1979, and that led Mayor Dutch Morial of New Orleans to cancel Mardi Gras. And then after that, Vincent was involved in politics, helped Mike Foster get elected governor in 1995, and by then, Vincent had discovered religion, become very, very strong believer in God, and he was very, very active in the Jefferson Parish Republican Party, and helped David Treen in his campaign against David Vitter in 1999 for Congress, and then played a role in bringing to light some information about David Vitter that was very tawdry and ended up hurting Vitter's campaign for governor in 2015.
And Vincent Bruno was 75 years old. He died of COVID. He was an anti-vaxxer, and the odds are such that if he'd been vaccinated, he might not have died. We don't know that, but we're going to miss him, and I wish he had been vaccinated. But he was quite a character, and John Pope, one of the best obit writers in the world, who reports for The Advocate and The Picayune now, where he spent many years in his career, he is preparing an obit, I understand, of Vincent Bruno, and it's an appropriate send-off for this fine man. 877-217-5757, talk at talklouisiana.org. Here's one from Jack on Highland, referring to your book, Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana, The Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards. Tyler Bridges, last week, I think it was Friday, LSU announced that its official partner on gambling is Caesars. Who would have thought it would come to this? Here you got a major university and one of the world's biggest gambling entities joining arms. What do you think?
Well, it's quite remarkable that only 10, 15 years ago, Jim, the college sports, the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, they all swore that they wanted nothing at all to do with the gambling companies, the casino companies. And times have changed. And with the legalization of betting after a Supreme Court decision, many, many states have now legalized gambling. I'm sorry, legalized sports betting. Louisiana is one of those states where the legislature and the governor approved that. And now we have LSU, we have NFL, we have my newspaper, The Advocate, are all making deals with gambling companies, and certainly Caesars seems to be at the top of the list for people to bet on sporting events, and for their partners to the partners of the gambling companies to get a share of the revenue.
I can only imagine what would happen to these partnerships if there were a scandal like there was in 1985 when I was a young reporter and the Tulane basketball program was shut down in a point shaving scandal. It is something that is legal, and I'm certainly somebody who quite likely will bet on a game or two, but there's still some bad actors in this industry, if you will, Tyler, and as you note, when you embrace gambling, as Louisiana has done, there is money, but there is also a downside.
Yeah, absolutely, and, you know, people with a historical reference, we'll remember the two NFL players in the night. I think it was 1963, Paul Hornung and Alex Karras, who were suspended for a year for having bet. And Pete Rose was a bet on his own games when he was a baseball player manager. And of course, the 1919 White Sox, or Black Sox, as they became infamously known, for having taken payoffs from gamblers to throw games. So certainly there is so much money in sports today that temptation is going to be out there, and certainly would not be surprised if something didn't happen. But again, professional sports, college sports are seeing this as a way of making more money. I guess that people are really into betting on sports, even – you know, who's going to win the coin toss for a football game. So it's the landscape has definitely changed, Jim.
And another listener, Holly in the Garden District, I referenced you in Jeremy's book, Long Shot, about the 2015 gubernatorial election. We'll have an open seat again in 2023. And that one is evolving 2 years out as what could be another, as Joe Dean would say, barn burner. What do you think?
Yeah, it seems to be when we have an open seat, generally it tends to be a very, very competitive election. And typically it also seems, Jim, as you know, that the sort of conventional wisdom gets upset as things go. You know, that Jeremy and I wrote this book, Long Shot. You know, very, very few people expected the long shot John Bel Edwards to win that governor's race. And certainly Bobby Jindal came from nowhere when he ran in 2003 in a race that he lost, but that set up his race in 2007. Certainly Mike Foster came from nowhere in 1995, Buddy Romer in 1987. Right now, the sort of the conventional candidates, I guess, would be Jeff Landry, the attorney general, and the lieutenant governor, Billy Nungesser. They both have clearly staked out the lane they want to run in. We hear some names of some others. But, Jim, as you know, it may be someone we're not even paying attention to who could somehow emerge as the candidate at this time 2 years from now or 3 years from now.
Well, it's 2023. So, yeah, so It's actually 2 years away, and the campaigning should begin probably.
2 years,
really, in truth, right now, Landry and Nungesser are already running, but the campaign should begin in earnest in about a year. But we've seen candidates pull back. John Kennedy was in the 2003 governor's election as a Democrat, and then pulled back when Bobby Jindal got in. Jindal got Mike Foster, governor's support. Kennedy decided to run for re-election for treasurer. So Landry or Nungesser could still pull back, but right now they're all in. And Tyler, we have this penchant in Louisiana of electing congresspeople, and it's because a member of the U.S. House has an off year and can run for governor and not lose his or her congressional seat. And we've done it with Bobby Jindal. We did it with Buddy Romer. We did it with Edwin Edwards. We did it with David Treen. It is a convenient way for a congressman to run and not really lose what Nungesser or Landry would lose if they were not victorious. I would suspect that we'll have at least one congressman run in 2023.
No, Jim, you make a great point, given that historical precedent. What we haven't really seen very much are is any of those members of Congress making much of a noise about running. And maybe they're all waiting to win re-election, including John Kennedy, next year before getting seriously involved. And certainly as a member of Congress, they can wait longer to raise money. But and also just you'll remember that Ralph Abraham ran as a member of Congress from Northeast Louisiana in that 2019 governor's race. So although he did start to get organize his campaign in 2018 before he won re-election.
And Tom on Bluebonnet says, don't discount Bill Cassidy, who could run. And he would be an interesting character because now he has inflamed many in the Republican ranks, but he's endeared himself to some who are on, quote, the other side.
Yeah, Jim, I'm on book leave right now from The Advocate up in Philadelphia, as you mentioned, working on my next book. But the last piece I wrote for The Advocate was about Bill Cassidy, and it's striking the number of conservative Republicans who are now bad-mouthing Senator Cassidy versus the number of Democrats who have applauded his decisions to certifying the election of President Biden and also working with the president and others, Republicans and Democrats, to craft this infrastructure bill. And so he has chosen, since winning re-election, to be more of a guy working with both parties.
Yeah, he's 64 years old. Who knows if he'll be running for more offices, but he started late as a Republican after being a lifelong Democrat and helping Democrats get elected through the years in Louisiana. If he were to actually switch and become a Democrat, that would be a fascinating prospect because he would, if he could clear the field, and the Democrats might do it if he switched, he would get presumably the Democratic vote and a few Republican votes, and that coalition might be similar to what got John Bel Edwards elected. Doubt that that will happen, but it is food for thought. And we're going to talk with Tyler Bridges about why in the world he is in the city of brotherly love at the University of Pennsylvania, the alma mater of Donald John Trump, and also Darlene Adams Rowland in our next segment. This is Jim Inkster wrapping it up with Pulitzer Prize winner, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, Tyler Bridges, who now is reporting in Louisiana, where he first made his splash back in the early David Duke years. And he's written two books about the wizard and the rise of David Duke and the rise and fall of David Duke. But he is in Philadelphia for a much different reason. And it is interesting that you are holed up at the library at the University of Pennsylvania, one of the great universities in America. Why are you there?
Well, let me make a small correction, Jim. I actually have an office, which is a strange thing. You know, reporters don't get offices. We just sit in a newsroom. But I actually have an office here at the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and I am indeed working on my next book. And before I get to that, let me just plug the book that just came out, if you don't mind. It's called The Flight, A Father's War, A Son's Search. And that story is about me piecing together my dad's story of a B-24 bomber who took off on October 1st, 1943, on a bombing mission. And then I tell what happens after that, and people could get a copy of that if they're interested at tylerbridges.com, and also the book we referenced earlier, Long Shot, that I did with Jeremy Alford. But the book that I'm doing now, Jim, is completely on a completely different topic. I describe it as the story behind the craziest finish ever to a college football game. And when I ask that question, that people sometimes say, you know, what do you think was the craziest football game? And LSU fans will cite one of those marathon overtime games, or I guess it was a game against Kentucky some number of years ago. But I contend, and everyone I've talked to seems to agree with me, even some former head coaches and current head coaches of football teams, and also John Elway, who I have interviewed at, that it was Stanford and Cal in 1982.
And the game ended in just an incredible way, and it broke the hearts of Stanford. And we'll be talking with Tyler about that in the year to come, but also we'll be visiting with him about the flight, a father's war, a son's search. And right now, I think a book festival is scheduled, so I hope you'll be there.
No, the Louisiana Book Festival was canceled. It was supposed to be held on late October.
Well, then we'll have to talk about it here then. We'll have all those authors who are going to be at the book festival here. That sounds like a winner. Tyler, congrats on your continuing success, and glad that you're continuing to work as fervently as you did 30 years ago. It's good to talk with you.
Always good to talk to you. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And we're joined in studio by a guest who's been with us many times, but it's been probably a year or so, maybe two. Darlene Adams-Rowland, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And she, I think, has been 13 years as executive director of one of the great entities in Baton Rouge. And we've had her on here talking about the Red Stick Farmers Market, Main Street. Tell us more. It's 25 years going, I believe, now.
That's right. Well,
Go ahead.
I did just take over in January, but I have been with the organization for 13 years. And, of course, we have the wonderful Farmers Market every Saturday downtown, and we have some special stuff going on in anticipation of our 25th anniversary in November. So this Saturday, we'd love everybody to come down. You know, we had planned our Farm Fed event, and as you were just talking about, COVID cancellations, we were one of the victims as well. So, but we're pivoting, and since we do have a weekly event, instead of having our in-person Farm Fet, we're going to do sort of a hybrid model. And this Saturday, we're going to have the band that was going to play at our event, John Gray Jazz Trio. They'll be at the market this Saturday.
Very good.
Which will be nice and festive. And if anyone's ever done a wine pool that are popular at fundraising events, we're going to move that to the market this Saturday as well. So We'll have some fun this Saturday, and then the original date for Farm Fet, September 30th, so we're going to keep that date for our fabulous online auction.
All right. So for those unfamiliar, and I know many have this as a big part of their lives, but others probably would if they knew more, and that's why you're here. It has taken a life of its own, hasn't it?
It really has. And, you know, I just met a couple that moved here from New Orleans last Saturday, and they were so excited to discover the farmers market downtown. Of course, we have our Thursday location as well that's really grown quite a bit and is a nice weekday stop at Pennington. But every Saturday, 8 to 12, downtown Baton Rouge, you'll find fresh fruits, vegetables, meats, honey, plants, just about anything locally made you could think of.
And you got John Gray down there.
Got John Gray, and you'll be able to see some of the great auction items. We have some really neat stuff like farm tours. You can go strawberry picking. We have to go to visit a local dairy and do cheese tastings. We have so many of our chefs who were going to participate in our event have now donated private dinners at Cocha and Eliza and Thomas House. So. Great.
Well, it's been part of the downtown revitalization. So it started 25 years ago. That would have been 1996. And downtown then was still evolving. All those new, beautiful buildings, Buddy Leach called them the marble palaces. They weren't quite up, but they are now. And the downtown area has truly been gentrified. It is a beautiful place, and the Red Stick Farmers Market is a big part of it. Now, did I hear you right? The virtual auction is still...
That will be on the 30th, and so the way you can sign up for that that's real easy is you just text the word farmer to the number 72727, and it'll text you back a link where you can view all the items and then sign up. So this is our big fundraiser for the year, so we encourage people to take a look and, you know, find something great to bid on and support Bretta and the Red Stick.
On the 30th?
On the 30th. You can text now, though, and go ahead and get pre-registered. And then we'll actually send you a text when it's live and open. But you can start viewing items right now. They're up. And
what are some of the items you can talk about?
So you have a private dinner at Homa's House for eight, I believe. Dinner at Cocha with Saskia and wine pairings. Chef at Eliza also has a private wine dinner there. We have one kind of fun item. We have an in-home opera serenade and dinner in your home by a local opera singer. So
who is stuff.
Misty Burns. She works with the Arts Council.
And she'll come to your home.
She'll come to your home. Her husband will cook a dinner for six, and she will serenade you while he serves you. So
wow.
Some neat stuff. And then, of course, we have great items from all of our farmers and vendors that have donated, whether it's tours, gift baskets, milk for a year, pick up your gallon every Saturday at the market, bread mm-hmm. for a year, some really fun, some neat things.
Well, these have been interesting times for, quote, nonprofits, haven't they?
They have been. You know, it's been challenging, obviously, to operate a public marketplace in the midst of COVID. But I think that we've found our stride, mm-hmm. and we feel like we're offering a safe place for people to shop. Then you throw a hurricane on top of it, which affected many of our farmers, especially to the east and the south. So another thing that's actually going on is we're raising money for our Small Farm Survival Fund, and all the mm-hmm. money goes directly to farmers who are affected.
Well, I hope you got some government assistance that was out there. I hope the Red Stick Farmers Market got included.
Well, we definitely have been applying for all the opportunities that are available.
As we know, the Penthouse Club got help, so I would think the Red Stick Farmers Market should if the Penthouse Club does.
Yes, absolutely.
There you go. Well, it is a part of the revitalization of downtown, but really, for a community like ours to be vibrant, we have to have something like this. I would think that 25 years ago, not every city had one, but now any city that's worth its salt probably does, right?
Well, you know, Jim, when I travel, it's the first thing that I seek out in a city, because I think you really get a feel for the local flavor, the community, the people. So to me, it's just a real gem of our community, and it is amazing. A lot of people still don't know about it, so that's why we like to come here and try to get the word out as much as we can that every Saturday, 8 to 12 downtown, you can go inside and have breakfast and shop. You can sit for a while. You can come outside. You know, it's unique. Most places have a farmer's market, but most places don't have the model that we have of an indoor yeah. and outdoor facility, so it's pretty unique nationwide.
Generally, are you able to track the number of people who are there?
We did a count a good while ago. We have plans to do one this fall. We just did a count at our Thursday market. And, you know, there's over 1,000 people just on Thursdays a lot of times.
On Thursday,
really,
and
grown.
I think Saturday
so
we had more. Saturday
is much larger. It yeah. really does. And then we did do what was interesting is the zip code survey at the Saturday market. And that was fascinating to see how far people travel mm-hmm. to come.
What's the biggest zip code for people going to the farmers
well,
market?
Well, of course, Mid-City is a very popular one, 06, 06, 08, 10, I think was a big one too. But we have people that come from Lake Charles frequently, yeah. like this mm-hmm. couple that drives. It's very interesting to see where people are coming from.
So 25 years, you've been there 13, and you've had a few different responsibilities, but you're the person in charge now, right?
That's right.
And that happened
in January.
So congratulations. And your background, Darlene, I think is an interesting part of the story. How did you get involved in this?
Well, you know, I always loved the farmers market. Even as a college student, I used to go when it was located over by the city government buildings. And I was working actually in finance in the mortgage industry, and then, of course, we know what happened with that in 08. So I was really looking to get more involved in something more community-focused.
So it was 2008. That's when you made the transition.
That's right.
Really?
That's right, yeah.
Well, the financial industry rolled merrily along, truly too big to fail, and the Red Stick Farmers Market is too big to fail. And congratulations, and again, this Saturday you'll have a big event, and then the virtual auction on the 30th. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support. Until tomorrow, for Alondra Villarreal, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay safe. Stay tuned.